2. The Second Declaration of War, 1947 to 1948. Partition, both in principle and in substance, can only be regarded as an anti-Arab solution. United Nations Special Commission on Palestine Minority Report. A few months before he died in 1968, my father, sensing that he had little time left, sat with me in our dining room and told me of a message he had been asked to deliver 2 decades earlier. I was a 19-year-old college student at this time. He bade me to listen carefully. In 1947, my father, Ismail Raghib al-Khaldi, returned to Palestine for the first time in 8 years. He had left in the fall of 1939 for graduate study at the University of Michigan and thereafter at Columbia University in New York, and had remained in the United States during World War II, working at the Office of War Information as an Arabic language broadcaster to the Middle East. During the war, my grandmother in Jaffa would stay up until after midnight to listen to the radio to hear her youngest son, whom she had not seen for years. At the time of his return visit to Palestine, he was serving as secretary of the newly formed Arab American Institute. My Lebanese-born mother worked there too. It was where my parents had met. The institute had been set up by a group of notable Arab Americans under the direction of Professor Philip Hitti of Princeton to raise American awareness of the situation in Palestine, and a Middle Eastern tour to introduce its work to the leaders of the newly independent Arab states had brought my father to Jerusalem. His brother, Dr. Hussein Fakhri al-Khaldi, the former mayor of Jerusalem, was older by 20 years. In view of the great age of their father and of Dr. Hussein's eminence, Ismail and the 3 other younger siblings, Ghalib, Fatima, and Yaqub, had been placed under the charge of Dr. Hussein, who oversaw discipline, money, and other matters. Another older brother, Ahmed, who was a widely recognized educator, writer, and the head of the government Arab college in Jerusalem, was in charge of their education. In spite of the 20-year age difference and Dr. Hussein's reputation for severity, he and my father were close, as is evidenced by their correspondence while Hussein was imprisoned by the British in the Seychelles Islands. In diaries written while he was in exile, Dr. Hussein complains at one point about the execrable English of a letter he received from my father. His writing is dreadful, and hopes that studying at the American University of Beirut would improve it. It did. Photos show that Dr. Hussein was a dignified and formidable-looking man, but by the late 1940s he was worn and much thinner than he had been before his nearly 7 years of imprisonment and exile. While in the Seychelles, he lost 24 pounds. As one of the few Arab leaders still in Jerusalem in late 1947, a time of great crisis for the Palestinians, he was intensely busy. Yet he summoned his youngest brother, and my father responded with alacrity. Dr. Hussein knew that Ismail was going to Amman at the behest of the Arab American Institute to see King Abdullah of Transjordan, and he wanted to send him a personal but official message. When my father heard its contents, he blanched. On behalf of Dr. Hussein and the Arab Higher Committee, of which he was the secretary, Ismail was to tell the king that while the Palestinians appreciated his offer of protection, he had used the Arabic wisaya, literally tutelage or guardianship. They were unable to accept. The implicit meaning of the message was that were the Palestinians to succeed in escaping the British yoke, they did not want to come under that of Jordan, which, given pervasive British influence in Amman, meant much the same thing. They aspired to control their own fate. My father weakly protested that passing on this most unwelcome news would ruin his visit, which was meant to gain the king's support for the work of the Arab American Institute. Dr. Hussein cut him off. Other envoys had brought King Abdullah the same message repeatedly, but he had refused to listen. Given the importance of family ties, he would be obliged to believe it, coming from Dr. Hussein's own brother. He curtly told Ismail to do as he had been asked, and ushered him out of the office. My father left with a heavy heart. Respect for his older brother obliged him to transmit the message, but he knew that his visit to Amman would not end well. K. King Abdullah received his guest and listened politely but without great interest to Ismail's enthusiastic report of how the Arab American Institute was working to change American opinion on Palestine, which, even then, was overwhelmingly pro-Zionist and largely ignorant of the Palestinian cause. For decades, the king had attached his fortunes to those of Great Britain, which subsidized his throne, paid for and equipped his troops, and officered his Arab Legion. By contrast, the United States seemed far away and insignificant, and the king appeared manifestly unimpressed. Like most Arab rulers at the time, he failed to appreciate the post-war role of the United States in world affairs. Having carried out the main part of his mission, my father then hesitantly conveyed the message Dr. Hussein had entrusted to him. The king's face registered anger and surprise, and he abruptly stood up, compelling everyone else in the room to stand as well. The audience was over. Exactly at that moment, a servant entered, announcing that the BBC had just broadcast the news of the UN General Assembly's decision in favor of the partition of Palestine. It happened that my father's meeting with the king had coincided with the Assembly's historic vote on November 29, 1947, on Resolution 181, which provided for partition. Before stalking out of the room, the king turned to my father and said coldly, "You Palestinians have refused my offer. You deserve what happens to you." What happened is, of course, now well known. By the summer of 1949, the Palestinian polity had been devastated and most of its society uprooted. Some 80% of the Arab population of the territory that at war's end became the new state of Israel had been forced from their homes and lost their lands and property. At least 720,000 of the 1.3 million Palestinians were made refugees. Thanks to this violent transformation, Israel controlled 78% of the territory of former Mandatory Palestine, and now ruled over the 160,000 Palestinian Arabs who had been able to remain, barely one-fifth of the pre-war Arab population. This seismic upheaval, the Nakba, or the catastrophe, as Palestinians call it, grounded in the defeat of the Great Revolt in 1939 and willed by the Zionist state in waiting, was also caused by factors that were on vivid display in the story my father told me, foreign interference and fierce inter-Arab rivalries. These problems were compounded by intractable Palestinian internal differences that endured after the defeat of the revolt, and by the absence of modern Palestinian state institutions. The Nakba was only finally made possible, however, by massive global shifts during World War II. The outbreak of war in 1939 put an end to the wrangling over the British White Paper and brought a relative lull after the upheavals of the revolt. Still, for 3 years, until the battles of El Alamein and Stalingrad in the fall of 1942, the danger of Nazi panzers arriving from Libya or through the Caucasus was ever present. Jewish immigration slowed significantly as a result of the White Paper and wartime conditions, while Zionist leaders, enraged at what they perceived as Whitehall's abandonment of its commitments to Zionism, shrewdly looked to engineer a diplomatic realignment away from Britain and toward new patrons. However, during this lull, the Zionists were able to continue to build up their military capabilities. Under pressure from the Zionist movement, and with support from British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, a Jewish brigade group of the British Army was formed in 1944, providing the already considerable Zionist military forces with training and combat experience, offering a vital advantage in the conflict to come. By contrast, although a wartime boom in Palestine enabled some recovery from the damage caused to the Arab economy by the revolt, the Palestinians remained fragmented politically, with many of their leaders still in exile or in British detention, and failed to make sufficient preparations for the brewing storm. Over 12,000 Palestinian Arabs volunteered for the British Army during World War II, while many others, like my father, did war work for the Allies. But unlike the Jewish soldiers from Palestine, they never constituted a single unit, and there was no Palestinian parastate to take advantage of the experience they had garnered. The end of the World War brought a new phase of the colonial assault on Palestine, launched by the arrival in the Middle East of two great powers that had previously played small regional roles, the United States and the USSR. An empire that had never fully acknowledged its colonial nature and whose domain had been restricted to the Americas and the Pacific, after Pearl Harbor, the United States suddenly became not just a global power, but the preeminent one. Starting in 1942, American ships, troops, and bases arrived in North Africa, Iran, and Saudi Arabia. They have not left the Middle East since. Meanwhile, the USSR, which had turned inward after the Bolshevik Revolution, spreading its ideology but avoiding projecting its strength, had the largest land army in the world as a result of the war, would liberate half of Europe from the Nazis, and became increasingly assertive in Iran, Turkey, and other areas to its south. Led by the dominant political figure in the Yishuv, David Ben-Gurion, the Zionist movement presciently foresaw the shift in the global balance of power. The key event in this realignment was the proclamation in 1942 at a major Zionist conference held at the Biltmore Hotel in New York of what was called the Biltmore Program. For the first time, the Zionist movement openly called for turning all of Palestine into a Jewish state. The exact demand was that Palestine be established as a Jewish commonwealth. As with the national home, this was another circumlocution for full Jewish control over the entirety of Palestine, a country with a two-thirds Arab majority. It was no coincidence that this ambitious program was proclaimed in the United States and in New York in particular, then and now the city with the largest Jewish population in the world. Before long, the Zionist movement had mobilized many American politicians and much of public opinion around this objective. This was a result both of this movement's unceasing and effective public relations efforts, which the Palestinians and the fledgling Arab states were unable to match, and of widespread horror at the revelation of the destruction of most of European Jewry by the Nazis in the Holocaust. After President Harry Truman endorsed the goal of a Jewish state and a majority Arab land in the post-war years, Zionism, once a colonial project backed by the declining British Empire, became part and parcel of the emerging American hegemony in the Middle East. Following the war, two crucial events that occurred in quick succession were emblematic of the obstacles ahead for the Palestinians. Their relations with many of the Arab regimes were already fraught because of the Arab rulers' alignment with Britain, going back to their intervention to end the 1936 general strike and their involvement in the failed 1939 St. James's Place conference. Things grew worse in March 1945 when, under the aegis of Great Britain, six Arab states formed the Arab League. In his memoirs, Dr. Hussein describes the Palestinians' bitter disappointment that the member states decided to remove references to Palestine from the League's inaugural communique and to retain control over the choice of Palestine's representative. The Egyptian prime minister blocked Musa al-Alami, the Palestinian emissary, from attending the League's founding conference, but reversed his decision immediately when al-Alami secured a letter from Brigadier Clayton, a British intelligence officer in Cairo, who authorized his participation. Although the Alexandria Protocol of October 1944, whereby Egypt, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and Transjordan originally agreed to create the League, had stressed the importance of the cause of the Arabs of Palestine while regretting the woes that have been inflicted on the Jews of Europe, these states were barely independent of their former colonial masters. Britain, in particular, had a powerful influence on the foreign policy of all of them, and British hostility toward any independent Palestinian initiative had not abated. This meant that the Palestinians could not count on any significant support from these weak and dependent Arab regimes. More far-reaching in its consequences was the formation of the Anglo-American Committee of Inquiry in 1946. This body was established by the British and U.S. governments to consider the urgent and pitiful situation of Jewish Holocaust survivors, 100,000 of whom were confined to displaced persons camps in Europe. The American and Zionist preference was for these unfortunates to be granted immediate entry to Palestine, neither the U.S. nor the U.K. being willing to accept them. in effect negating the thrust of the 1939 White Paper. The Palestinian case was presented to the committee by Albert Hourani, later to become perhaps the greatest historian in the modern Middle East, who, with colleagues in the newly formed Palestinian Arab office, had produced a large quantity of materials that was transmitted in written and oral form. Their main effort was embodied in Hourani's testimony, which offered a prescient description of the devastation and chaos that the creation of a Jewish state would wreak on Palestinian society, and so throughout the Arab world. He warned the committee that in the past few years, responsible Zionists have talked seriously about the evacuation of the Arab population, or part of it, to other parts of the Arab world. The implementation of the Zionist program, he said, would involve a terrible injustice and could only be carried out at the expense of dreadful repressions and disorders, with the risk of bringing down in ruins the whole political structure of the Middle East. The multiple military coups by Arab officers who had fought in Palestine and then overthrew regimes in Syria, Egypt, and Iraq from 1949 to 1958, the eruption of the Soviet Union into the affairs of the Middle East in the mid-1950s, and the expulsion of Britain from the region can all be seen as aftershocks of the earthquake that Hourani had foreseen. At the time, these outcomes may have seemed far-fetched to the 12 American and British committee members who heard Hourani's testimony. Reflecting the new balance of power between Britain and the United States, the committee ignored the case made by the Arabs and the preference of the British government, which was to continue to limit Jewish immigration to Palestine to avoid antagonizing the country's Arab majority and the population of the newly independent Arab states. The committee came to conclusions that mirrored precisely the desires of the Zionists and the Truman administration, including the recommendation to admit 100,000 Jewish refugees to Palestine. This signified that the 1939 White Paper was indeed a dead letter, that Britain no longer had the decisive voice in Palestine, and that it was the United States that would become the predominant external actor there, and eventually in the rest of the Middle East. Both events show clearly that at this advanced stage of the struggle to retain control of their homeland, the Palestinians had not developed effective Arab allies or the apparatus of a modern state. Despite their intense patriotic feeling and the formation of a national movement strong enough to briefly pose a threat to British control of Palestine during the revolt. This absence meant that they were facing the well-developed parastate of the Jewish agency without having a central state system themselves. This proved to be a fatal weakness militarily, financially, and diplomatically. Unlike the Jewish agency, which had been granted vital arms of governance by the League of Nations mandate, the Palestinians had no foreign ministry, no diplomats, as my father's story attests, nor any other government department, let alone a centrally organized military force. They had neither the capacity to raise the necessary funding, nor international assent to creating state institutions. When Palestinian envoys had managed to meet with foreign officials, whether in London or Geneva, they were condescendingly told that they had no official standing, and that their meetings were therefore private rather than official. The comparison with the Irish, the only people to succeed in partially freeing themselves of colonial rule between World Wars I and II, is striking. In spite of divisions in their ranks, their clandestine parliament, the Dáil Éireann, their nascent branches of government, and their centralized military forces ultimately out-administered and out-fought the British. During these critical years leading up to the Nakba, Palestinian disarray in regard to institution building was profound. The rudimentary nature of the organizational structures available to the Palestinians is clear from the recollections of Yusuf Sayegh, who was appointed as the first Director General of the newly created Arab National Fund in 1946. The fund had been established by the Arab Higher Committee in 1944 to serve as a state treasury and an equivalent to the Jewish National Fund, which by then was almost half a century old. By the mid-1930s, the JNF was annually collecting $3.5 million for the colonization of Palestine in the United States alone, part of much larger sums it regularly channeled from all over the world to support the Zionist project. The Arab National Fund only began its task of collecting resources after Sayegh was appointed and developed a structure for its efforts. Sayegh recounted the many difficulties he faced in his work, from setting up a countrywide network from scratch, to accepting donations, to the difficulties of moving about the countryside as the security situation in Palestine deteriorated. By mid-1947, in a little over a year, the fund had managed to raise 176,000 Palestine pounds, over $700,000 at the time, an impressive sum given the relative poverty of the population. It paled in contrast to the fundraising muscle of the Zionist movement, however, when, against Sayegh's advice, a member of the fund's board, Izzat Tannous, boasted to the press about the sum. Sayegh and his colleagues learned the next day of a gift of £1 million, $4 million, to the JNF by a rich Jewish widow from South Africa. Sayegh's portrayal of the Arab Higher Committee, the Palestinian leadership body formed in 1936, disbanded by the British in 1937 and reconstituted after the war, is equally harsh. A tableau of disorganization and infighting. It should be remembered that the AHC had been outlawed and all its leaders had been imprisoned or exiled by the British during the revolt, or were forced to flee the country to escape arrest. Some, like the Mufti, were exiled permanently, while others, among them Dr. Hussein, the Mufti's cousin Jamal al-Husseini, and Musa al-Alami, were only allowed to return to Palestine many years later, after being exiled in different countries. However, their return did not solve the problem. Sayegh describes the situation when the committee, which had no bureaucratic apparatus, was suddenly faced with the daunting task of documenting the Palestinian case to the Anglo-American Committee of Inquiry. Sayegh wrote, "Now the Arab Higher Committee realized it didn't have the intellectual skills among its members. Indeed, it had no structure at all. When Jamal Husseini left the office in the afternoon, he locked the door and put the key in his pocket. There was no secretariat, absolutely no secretariat, one or two people to make coffee, not even a secretary who would take notes or type. It was that empty, the whole thing." The situation was in fact even worse, given the deep political and personal differences that divided its members and the inter-Arab rivalries that swirled around the AHC. All of these ills crippled the potential of another new organization formed in the immediate post-war era, the Arab Office, which the AHC had tasked with making the Palestinian argument to the Anglo-American Committee. Set up as the nucleus of a Palestinian foreign ministry and supported mainly by the pro-British Iraqi government headed by Nouri al-Sa'id, the Arab Office had both a diplomatic and informational mission, with the goal of making the Palestinian cause better known. In contrast to the disarray of the other bodies, the Arab Office housed an extraordinary and highly motivated group of men. I have not seen an account of a single woman involved with its work. They included Musa al-Alami, its founder, the noted educator Darwish al-Miqdadi, the lawyer Ahmed Shuqairi, who became the first head of the PLO, the future historian Albert Hurani, and his younger brother Cecil, and younger men such as the economist Burhan Dajani, Wasfi Al-Tal, later the Jordanian prime minister, and my cousin Walid Khaldi, who also went on to become a renowned academic. It was this group that put together the remarkably cogent, prescient, and ignored presentation delivered to the Committee of Inquiry by Albert Hurani. With its resources of talent, the Arab Office held promise to fill the function of a professional diplomatic service, such as would obviate the need, for example, for Dr. Hussein to use his young brother as an envoy. Advanced modern states do occasionally use personal envoys to convey messages alongside more conventional channels, but the Palestinians had been allowed no such channels by the British mandate. However, this condition also arose partly from the strongly patriarchal, hierarchical, and fractious nature of their politics, especially before the era of mass-based political parties. But the Arab Office failed to remedy this condition. Yusuf Sayegh's and Walid Khalidi's recollections attest to the challenges that hamstrung the Palestinians at every turn. ultimately undermining efforts to establish competent bodies to represent them internationally. Moreover, by 1947, Al-Alami and Dr. Hussein, the two Palestinian leaders perhaps best suited to deal with matters of diplomatic representation, were no longer allies. Waleed Khalidi describes how Al-Alami's high-handedness alienated colleagues, for which there is ample evidence in Dr. Hussein's memoirs. More important, Al-Alami's closeness to the pro-British Iraqi regime provoked the suspicions of many Palestinian figures. These inter-Palestinian differences, exacerbated by the rivalries between the newly independent Arab states, are described by Dr. Hussein in painful detail. As he shows, much of the pre-war polarization between partisans and opponents of the Mufti, Hajj Amin al-Husseini, dating to the revolt and before, continued into the post-war era. The polarization was intensified by Britain's unremitting opposition to both the Mufti and any independent Palestinian political entity, which they feared, probably rightly, would be hostile to Britain. This hostility to much of the Palestinian leadership was echoed by most Arab governments, over which the UK still had great influence. Britain's deft behind-the-scenes management of Palestine's representation at the Arab League's founding conference in March 1945 provides a striking example of that influence. Musa al-Alami, who did finally attend the conference, was an able lawyer, according to Dr. Hussein, and spoke well in defense of the Palestinian cause. But he was also very much in the confidence of the British, who sent him on diplomatic missions on their behalf all over the region in 1945 to 1946, at one point providing him with a British bomber for trips to Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and other Arab countries. Convinced that Britain, which did not have the best interests of the Palestinians at heart, had too much influence on Al-Alami via its support for the Arab office, Dr. Hussein publicly criticized its performance, implicitly criticizing Al-Alami. One day in 1947, he received a visit in his Jerusalem office from a colonel of British military intelligence, who after a general discussion spoke highly of Al-Alami and of the Arab office's work for the Arab cause and for greater understanding and closeness between the Arab and British peoples. Dr. Hussein, whose hostility to Britain had intensified after the crushing of the Great Revolt and his own years of British-imposed exile, kept his views to himself but was puzzled by the visit. When he continued to disparage the Arab office publicly for its failure to coordinate with the Arab Higher Committee, his military visitor returned. This time the colonel remained standing while bluntly delivering his message. "We respect the director of the Arab offices and have full confidence in him, and we want you to cooperate with him." Dr. Hussein responded coldly, "Your respect for him and your confidence in him is your business, not mine. My cooperation or non-cooperation with him is my concern, not yours. Good morning, Colonel." From the moment Al-Alami was admitted to the Arab League, Dr. Hussein notes bitterly, he became a representative of the British government and not that of the Arabs of Palestine. Musa al-Alami had also managed to earn the distrust of Hajj Amin al-Husseini, the still exiled Mufti, who after relocating to Cairo from Germany in 1946 had immediately re-engaged in Palestinian politics. From his place of exile, he could no longer control events in Palestine, but he was still considered the paramount leader, and for a time, he continued to exercise influence in spite of the lasting damage his presence in Nazi Germany during the war had done to the Palestinian cause. Al-Alami had initially been acceptable to all concerned as the head of the Arab office because he was not aligned with any Palestinian faction. It helped that his sister was married to the Mufti's cousin, Jamal al-Husseini. However, by 1947, that non-alignment came to irk the Mufti, who prized loyalty above all other virtues. Yusuf Sayyir, whose work with the Arab National Fund involved meeting the Mufti several times, was positively inclined toward him, but he nevertheless understood the profound limitations of the Mufti's traditional style of leadership. The basic weakness of the Mufti was that he thought that the merit of the cause he was working for, namely, setting up an independent Palestine, saving Palestine from takeover by the Zionists, was enough in itself. Because it was a just cause, he did not build a fighting force in the modern sense. I think part of it was that he feared a big organization. He felt that he could not control a big organization. He could control an entourage, people to whom he whispered, and who'd whisper to him. A big organization would have to be decentralized to a certain point, and he would lose touch. And perhaps he would have to depend on them, and they would depend less on him. Perhaps he was afraid that some leading young fighter would emerge who would be charismatic and would take away some of the loyalty and support that was his. Much in this acute analysis of the patriarchal nature of the Mufti's approach applied to the entire generation of men of his class born during the late Ottoman era who dominated the Palestinian leadership, and for that matter, politics in most of the Arab world. There were nascent political parties with a diverse social base in Palestine and elsewhere, such as the Syrian National Party, to which Sayyih belonged. But except for Egypt, where the Wafd, a genuine mass-based political party, had dominated the country's politics since 1919, nowhere had these formations developed to the point that they eclipsed the politics of the notables. As Albert Hourani masterfully described it in a famous 1968 essay, having been financed primarily by Iraq's Nouri al-Said and his British-backed government, the Arab office eventually alienated other Arab states, notably Egypt and Saudi Arabia, which both aspired to pan-Arab leadership. Their leaders, as well as those of Syria and Lebanon, suspected, probably correctly, that the creation of the Arab office was a vehicle for Iraq's regional ambitions. Other such vehicles included a project for federation among the countries of the Fertile Crescent, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Palestine, behind which Nouri's rivals feared lurked his patron, Great Britain. The Arab state's opposition, expressed through the Arab League in Cairo, itself under Egyptian influence, gravely undermined the authority and capacity of the Arab office, ultimately further weakening the Palestinians. Meanwhile, King Abdullah of Transjordan had his own ambitions to dominate as much as possible of Palestine, having done his best to come to terms with both the Zionists and his British backers over his plans for the country. As Avi Shlaim reports in Collusion Across the Jordan, his account of this era, extensive clandestine contact took place between King Abdullah and Jewish agency leaders, later Israeli prime ministers Moshe Sharet and Golda Meir. As the United Nations moved toward partition of Palestine, the king repeatedly met with them secretly in the hope of reaching an accord in which Jordan would incorporate the part of Palestine to be designated for its Arab majority. The king confidently gave them his assurances that the Palestinians would come around and assent to his rule. Thus, Abdullah, unlike Iraq's Nouri, had no use for any form of independent Palestinian leadership or for a body like the Arab office that would serve as their diplomatic arm. Beyond the strength and broad external support enjoyed by the Zionists, in contrast with the weakness and fragmentation of the Palestinian national movement, the newly independent Arab states, Iraq, Transjordan, Egypt, Syria, and Lebanon, were frail and fraught with rancorous disunity, and the Palestinians had to contend with their dueling ambitions. In his attempt to impose his tutelage on the Palestinians, King Abdullah was in competition with Egypt's King Farouk and King Abdul Aziz ibn Saud of Saudi Arabia. Other Arab leaders occasionally entertained complex, ambiguous, and surreptitious contacts with the Zionist movement, often to the detriment of the Palestinians. At the same time, many Arab rulers continued to lean heavily on personal relations with undependable British advisors, even as British power was waning. King Abdullah, his brother King Faisal of Iraq, and his successors there, and King Abdul Aziz ibn Saud, relied on British officials, current or former, whose positions were ambiguous. One such was the commander of Abdullah's army, Lieutenant General Sir John Bagot Glubb, known as Glubb Pasha. In some cases, these rulers were obliged by treaty to have such advisors, all of whom owed their primary loyalty to Great Britain, not to the Arab leaders they advised. This was also the case with the foreign diplomats from whom the Arab leaders accepted counsel and sometimes orders. The British ambassador's residence in Amman abutted the royal palace, providing for a short trip through the back garden to offer guidance to the king. At times, such advice was quite muscular. In 1942, Ambassador Sir Miles Lampson, unhappy with the Egyptian government of the day, ordered British tanks to surround Abdeen Palace in Cairo, entered the palace grounds in his Rolls Royce, had the palace doors shot open, and commanded King Farouk to appoint Britain's choice of prime minister. This same prime minister, Mustafa Nahas Pasha, was the one who refused to allow Musa al-Alami to represent Palestine at the Arab League. But the quick reversal of his decision by a British intelligence officer showed where the real power resided in Cairo. However much Arab leaders may have wished to demonstrate their post-war independence, the poor backward states they led were entangled in a thick web of dependency based on unequal treaties, continued foreign military occupation, and external control of their natural and other resources. In relation to the newly powerful United States, the Arab leaders, many of them chosen by their European overlords for their pliability, demonstrated feebleness combined with a striking lack of expertise and global awareness. King Abdulaziz of Saudi Arabia, who had farsightedly signed a crucial agreement with American oil companies in 1933, to the detriment of British oil interests, met with an ailing Franklin D. Roosevelt on board a U.S. warship in the spring of 1945, weeks before the American leader's death. He received reassuring pledges directly from the president that the United States would do nothing to harm the Arabs of Palestine and would consult with the Arabs before taking any action there. These promises were casually disregarded by Roosevelt's successor, Harry Truman. But because of the Saudi regime's economic and military dependency on the United States, the king refrained from protesting or exerting influence decisively in favor of the Palestinians, nor did any of his six sons who succeeded him. This dependency and the ignorance of generation after generation of Arab rulers about the workings of the American political system and international politics would consistently deprive the Arab world of any possibility of resisting American influence or shaping U.S. policy. By contrast, the Zionist movement applied a highly developed understanding of global politics, complementing its origins in Europe among well-educated, assimilated Jews such as Theodor Herzl and Chaim Weizmann. The movement also drew on deep roots and extensive connections in the United States, established decades before my father's meeting with King Abdullah. David Ben-Gurion and Yitzhak Ben-Zvi, later the second president of Israel, had spent several years at the end of World War I working for the Zionist cause in the United States, where Golda Meir had lived since childhood. Meanwhile, no members of the Palestinian leadership had ever visited the United States. My father was the first of his family to do so. Compared with the sophisticated grasp the Zionist leadership had of European and other Western societies, of which most of them were natives or citizens, Arab leaders had at best a limited understanding of the politics, societies, and cultures of the countries of Europe, to say nothing of the nation's superpowers. The Palestinian and Arab disunity conveyed by the accounts of my father, Dr. Hussein, Yusuf Sayegh, and Walid Khalidi, the intrigue and infighting they describe, were ultimately disastrous. Not just for the plan for the Arab office to represent the Palestinians internationally, but also for their prospects in the climactic conflict of 1947 to 1948. They entered this fateful contest woefully unprepared, both politically and militarily, and with a fragmented and dispersed leadership. Moreover, they had little external support except from the deeply divided and unstable Arab states, still under the influence of the old colonial powers, and which had poor and largely illiterate populations. This was in stark contrast to the international standing and the strong modern para-state built up by the Zionist movement over several decades. Since 1917, the Palestinian national movement had been faced with the antagonistic tandem of Britain and its protege, the Zionist project. But the Yishuv had grown more and more hostile to its British patron after the passage of the 1939 White Paper. This hostility erupted with assassinations of British officials, such as that by the Stern Gang in 1944 of Lord Moyne, the resident minister in Egypt, and was followed by a sustained campaign of violence against British troops and administrators in Palestine. This culminated in the 1946 blowing up of the British HQ, the King David Hotel, with the loss of 91 lives. The British soon found themselves unable to master the armed opposition of virtually the entire Yishuv, whose potent military and intelligence organizations they had themselves reinforced during the Great Revolt and World War II. Reeling from deep post-war economic and financial problems, and the unwinding of the centuries-old Indian Raj, Great Britain finally capitulated in Palestine. In 1947, the Clement Attlee government dumped the problem of Palestine into the lap of the new United Nations, which formed a UN Special Commission on Palestine, UNSCOP, to provide recommendations for the future of the country. At the UN, the dominant powers were the United States and the Soviet Union, a development the Zionist movement had shrewdly anticipated with its diplomatic efforts toward both, but which left the Palestinians and the Arabs flat-footed. The post-war realignment of international power was apparent in the workings of UNSCOP, and in its majority report in favor of partitioning the country in a manner that was exceedingly favorable to the Jewish minority, giving them over 56% of Palestine, against the much smaller 17% for the Jewish state envisioned by the 1937 Peel Partition Plan. It was visible as well in the pressure that went into fashioning General Assembly Resolution 181, which resulted from the UNSCOP majority report. The November 29, 1947 passage in the UN General Assembly of Resolution 181, which called for dividing Palestine into a large Jewish state and a smaller Arab one, with an international corpus separatum encompassing Jerusalem, reflected the new global balance of power. The United States and USSR, which both voted in favor of the resolution, now clearly played the decisive role in sacrificing the Palestinians for a Jewish state to take their place and control over most of their country. The resolution was another declaration of war, providing the international birth certificate for a Jewish state in most of what was still an Arab-majority land, a blatant violation of the principle of self-determination enshrined in the UN Charter. The expulsion of enough Arabs to make possible a Jewish-majority state necessarily and inevitably followed. Just as Balfour did not think that Zionism would hurt the Arabs, it is doubtful that when Truman and Stalin pushed through UNGA 181, they or their advisors paid much heed to what would happen to the Palestinians as a consequence of their vote. Meanwhile, the creation of a Jewish state was no longer the outcome sought by Britain. Infuriated by the violent Zionist campaign that had driven it from Palestine and not wishing to further alienate the Arab subjects of its remaining Middle Eastern empire, Britain abstained in the partition resolution vote. From the 1939 White Paper onward, British policymakers had recognized that their country's predominant interests in the Middle East lay with the independent Arab states and not with the Zionist project that Britain had nurtured for over two decades. With the UN partition decision, the Zionist movement's military and civil structures were backed by both of the nascent superpowers of the post-war era and could prepare to take over as much of the country as possible. The catastrophe that ensued for the Palestinians was thus the product not only of their own and Arab weaknesses and of Zionist strength, but also of events as far afield as London, Washington, D.C., Moscow, New York, and Amman.